Hey.
Hey, everybody.
We're going to do a super fast podcast this time because we spent a lot of time talking about more interesting things than baseball, and now we only have a half hour. So yeah. Lots of content to get to, 30 minutes.
This isn't going to be like when I'm like super quick bullet point post and it's like 7,000 words. This is actually, I don't know how long we'll talk, but it'll be cut off at half an hour anyway.
Yeah. Literally a ticking clock on this one, so right, we should stop talking about that and get to the actual stuff.
Yeah, because, I mean, we wouldn't want to ever run out of time. That would be just a complete waste of the podcast. And the time that we have at our disposal, that we wasted a lot of it.
Yes.
Just talking. This is one of those things that's probably funny but impossible to listen to as well. You know, like really awkward teenager scenes in movies. It's like, oh, I remember that. I relate to it. But, oh, my God, this is uncomfortable.
Like, I don't like those scenes.
I don't either, but they really don't. Do have humor value in them. And right now there are people listening. They're like, holy shit, it's been 3 minutes, and they haven't said a damn word about the Seattle Mariners baseball is the topic that we're going to be talking about on this podcast, because I don't think we've podcasted since the offseason really began. I don't actually remember. I know we did one after the World Series, shortly before the World Series.
Right before the World Series started, and we did one after the series, but for the life of me, I don't know what we talked about. I don't really remember what we talk about an hour after these are done.
Yeah.
And that's right.
Cool. Well, we're not talking about that now because the Mariners have done some stuff over the last several weeks that you already know all about, so we're going to talk about them some more because Matthew's out of the country.
Yes. Well, and follow baseball only through our podcast to win the Cy Young Award.
Yay. Felix. So I guess we can expect him to be traded to Milwaukee in a year.
Yeah. That'd be weird.
I was reading an interview with Zach Greinke, and he said that when he was building his no-trade clause list, he had to double think about Milwaukee, and then as he didn't want to go there because he didn't think they were going to win, and then they traded for Sean Markham, and they kept Prince Fielder, and Zach Greinke was like, that's one of the top three places I want to go to. It's like, Milwaukee? It's just a weird thing to want.
Yeah.
I don't know where he's from. I don't think Zach Greinke cares where he's from. Maybe I shouldn't fall into the trap pretending.
I mean, he's gone in 2 years anyways.
Yeah. But, I mean, that's going to be weird when he's a free agent. I mean, is he going to automatically seek the biggest contract?
He might be one of those people where the place actually matters a lot.
Yeah, but I guess who the hell knows, because who understands Zach Greinke?
Right. Or anybody for that matter, but yeah, more so Zach Greinke.
Well, we don't understand.
I like it. I like unexpectedness, and Zach Greinke getting traded to Milwaukee, of all places, was unexpected.
Yeah. No, I think it was a lot of fun. I think it's great that just a couple of weeks after I wrote about how this offseason is going to be a complete nightmare, the Angels have done, I mean, they've signed two relievers, like good relievers, but they've signed two relievers. Oakland has made some moves, but Oakland, they're not that much better than they were. Texas hasn't gotten Lee, they haven't gotten an outfield, they haven't gotten the starting pitcher, Greinke's gone. The Red Sox did everything, the Yankees have done nothing. The Yankees have done nothing but re-sign Rivera and Jeter, which is just insane to me.
Yeah, and it seems like they might lose Pettit as well.
Yeah, and I mean, they would have to blow Pettit away now with an offer because he's going to have less reason to want to come back because he would come back for a World Series, you know?
Right.
He should go to Houston.
He could.
Yeah.
Or Milwaukee.
Yeah. Man. It's weird to think about Milwaukee being a good team. I don't know anything about the bullpen. The fourth and fifth starters aren't special. I don't actually know how good their offense is anymore since Betancourt sucks and Gomez sucks and
other Yeah, it's people. Tough. It's also just hard to put any focus on them when you have the Phillies there.
Yeah. But, I mean, the Phillies, I guess we don't need to get into this right now because we are limited now to about 23 minutes of podcast.
So since we last podcasted, the Mariners have signed Miguel Olivo, they signed Jack Cuss, and they've traded for Brandon Ryan.
And they've re-signed Eric Bedard, they got rid of Ryan Roland Smith.
Yeah, those things don't matter. But
well, Bedard matters. Maybe it's fun to think of Bedard mattering.
I guess I wanted to talk about Jack Cuss because it was what's curious to me is as I've read through some like fan reactions, not necessarily to the Cuss signing, but just to I think was more in the light of the Brendan Ryan trade. Mm-hmm. When people kept talking about, you know, the expected reaction of Brendan Ryan being another no hit, well, you know, born to be Mariner, and people were kind of summarizing the offseason, you know, we're just shuffling the deck chairs. We haven't actually signed any offense. We've got an, and they would even still bring up our DH, and they'd bring up like Jack Cust as being not like a no hit DH. And I'm just like, what? Jack Cust's reputation is only that he can hit. If he's known for two things, it's that he can't field and that he hits dingers.
Yeah.
I just don't understand it. It's just like another level of willful ignorance because there's the, you know, you're already got level one where they're not understanding that defense, you know, matters and runs a, you know, run saved is equal to a run earned for the most part and et cetera. And Brendan Ryan, even as bad as a hitter as he's going to be, is an improvement over last year and offensive regression. There's all that kind of levels of ignorance that's going on. But then there's the, it's just, how do you look at Jack Cust and come to the conclusion that he's not going to hit?
Well, I guess for one thing, Cust, he was a good hitter when he first came up with Oakland. He obviously had the statistical reputation as a minor leaguer. He never really hit to such a level that he put himself in everyone's mind. So not a lot of people knew about Jack Cust. He had 33 home runs in 2008, whatever, but he never really blew people away. And then the last 2 years, he has gotten worse. And last year, his numbers were greatly inflated by his batting average and balls in play. And, you know, the year before, he was a slightly above average hitter. Last year, you had process versus results. The core numbers weren't spectacular. His power wasn't there. So I think there is concern that Jack Cust won't hit much. I think it's still a safe bet he's going to be the second best, maybe even the best hitter on the team, depending on Ichiro's fluctuations and whether Cust bounces back. So I don't, the Mariners didn't sign Jack Cust from 2008 or 2007, you know. They signed Jack Cust now in his low 30s, coming off a couple down years where there's questions now. How many dingers is he actually going to hit?
Well, I mean, I don't think that's the sort of analysis that they're using. But two, I mean, he was still, I mean, the power was slightly gone, but he was still, you know, a pretty well above average hitter
mm-hmm.
in 2010.
I mean, he obviously drew a lot of
even walks. Considering that he only played, you know, 2/3 of a season.
Mm-hmm.
He still racked up more than enough hitting to be worth it. Yeah, a lot of that was a high average, you know, inflated average for him, but you know, his power and his power is, yeah, it's been down for the last 2 years, but it's still pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, he's probably going to lead the team in home runs next season, which is kind of embarrassing, kind of not. And he'll hit his dingers, he'll draw his walks, and he'll be productive. People aren't going to like him a whole lot just because he won't be what they miss of Russell Branning. I don't think he'll hit as many home runs. I think he's probably a little less likable, it seems like, which is hilarious given their backgrounds if you actually think about it. But people are going to want Russell Branning and his like 30 to 40 dinger power and his like his absolute moonshots, and Cust doesn't hit home runs the way Brandon hits them. But I mean, I've never watched a team like my team with Jack Cust before. Maybe he will feel fun to have in the middle of the lineup, or maybe we won't trust him because his walks will just disappear like Sean Figgins' walks did, where we just kind of forget that he drew a lot of walks. So I don't know. I don't know what it's going to feel like to have Jack Cust, but I know that I've wanted to find out for about 10 years.
Yeah. And you know what? It's not Mike Sweeney and it's not Ken Griffey Jr., so...
Yeah.
Do people still remember that? That was our DH in 2010, was Ken Griffey Jr. and Mike Sweeney.
Wasn't the DH OPS like 600 for us?
It was roughly around that, yeah.
Yeah. Holy shit. 600. This is just going to be, it doesn't matter if Cust continues his somewhat slow, gradual decline. He's still going to be such an enormous upgrade over last year's DH that whenever people come out with like the Mariners projected win total and You might be like, whoa, where did all those wins come from? They lost 101 games last year. Well, you know, we're not going to lose 20 games because we can't get a single hit out of DH, except for that one, which is like the last hit of Griffey's career, which won a game. But
right.
Wow.
Of course, I don't know, we say this, but I don't know how many years in a row about how many different positions on the team we can keep saying, well, it can't be worse than last year.
For every, I don't know, four positions where we say we're filling the black hole and that'll make us better. One of them's probably going to be a black hole or another black hole is going to emerge. And I think maybe a fun topic for later would be trying to predict what the black holes will be. I mean, we already know shortstop, but outside of that, we'll talk about the later since we're constricted. Why don't we, unless you have more on Cuss, why don't we talk about Miguel Leiva a little bit?
I didn't have any more than Cust. That was just my only little thing about him.
Cool. All right. Fuck Cust. On to Miguel Olivo.
And in kind of the same vein with Miguel Olivo, that I feel like people are unfairly docking him performance for some unknown reason.
Well, I think it's clearly the...
Well, it's not an unknown reason. Yeah. It's because he was so bad with us in 2004, 2005. But it's also like, come on, people. That was 5 years ago. And since he left the Mariners, he's been an above-average player every single season.
Yeah, and it's going to be hard because he makes outs all the time. And last year's OBP was, just like Cust, inflated because of batting average, ball of play, whatever. He's not going to get on base 32% of the time. He's going to get on base maybe 27 or 28% of the time, most likely.
It's so hilariously bad.
Yeah, his on base is just absolutely atrocious. But you don't get Miguel Leiva because you think he's going to get on base.
Yeah, I could say that I think, well, there's pretty much every position on the team I could easily envision turning into a black hole except Ichiro and I guess Felix. But I think Miguel Olivo might be the easiest one because if he comes back to Safeco Field and he doesn't have and he's not hitting home runs, if you know he gets caught in the power alleys or mentally or whatever, he's an atrocious black hole because he can't he can't get on base.
Yeah.
He needs to hit home runs to be worth anything. And then it's just one of those things where if he does, if the home run power translates, well, then he's an above average catcher. I feel like Miguel Olivo's either going to post negative war or he's going to post 2+ war. It's going to be nothing in between.
His slumps are just going to be the most unwatchable. But it's going to be weird with Olivo because it'll be like one home run every week and a half. And his numbers would be, that's just off the top of my head. But then, like, the things that will pull his numbers up are going to be so infrequent that he might feel like he's worth it.
He'll always feel like he's in a slump.
Yeah. And then it'll be like, bam, home run. Maybe he's heating up. No, this is just what he does. Like, three, four home runs every month, and then that's it. And you'll look at his numbers maybe after a little while and realize, well, he's slugging 420. You know, for a catcher, that's okay. But nobody's going to like him, except Felix.
I don't think it's going to work out, but I really, really want to see a batting order that goes like Figgins, Olivo, Cust. Just to go from like the guy who doesn't swing at anything and no power to the guy who swings at everything and, you know, might have power to the guy who doesn't swing at anything, but has tons of power. It just feels like the most schizophrenic, like if you were a pitcher, that would just screw with your plan.
I wonder who is the most fun kind of batter for a pitcher to face. Do you think it's the guy, like the slap hitter who's annoying? I doubt it. And I think pitchers love the idea of getting strikeouts and being able to throw whatever they want. So Olivo is probably the kind of guy that pitchers love going up against.
The answer to that question is Jose Lopez.
All right, swings at everything and no power at all. But
and no power, right.
Who actually would have a career.
Or the slightly expanded answer, the 2010 Seattle Mariners.
Just ask Dallas Braden.
And, you know, everybody else.
And
but,
everybody else.
Yeah, so I'm bipolarly optimistic about Miguel Leiva. I don't know how to phrase I think he might post the best catching numbers that we've seen in since, you know, good Kenji.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he's number one on my list to, oh, God, this is somehow worse than 2010. Because I could see it. I could see Miguel Olivo being worse than what we got out of Rob Johnson and Adam Moore.
It's obviously easy for us to visualize what bad Olivo looks like because we've had some experience with bad Olivo. I mean, he did play 104 games with the Mariners, over which he got on base 22% of the time. And he actually, his power was okay, but his, when you hit 176, you're not gonna, you know, but, and his throwing arm is good, his catching is bad, but we're used to that, so we're probably not even going to notice. And it is probably, I think it's better for Adam Moore to have an actual starter, not only for competition, but also because it just gives, it lessens the load on Moore a little bit. And worst comes to worst, if Olivo ends up untradeable or we have to cut him or, you know, if Olivo's just crap, it's only $3.5 million a year. It's not the end of the world. We have a lot of money coming off the books after this season, I think. I haven't actually double checked, but I think that's true. Like the whole
Silva Bradley, yeah, we have a lot of money coming off.
Yeah. So, you know, even if Oliva's a disaster, and I think a lot of people believe that he will be a disaster, it's just not that big. It's like the Justin Spire contract with the Angels. It didn't kill them. He was just a bad middle reliever that they got rid of. So you stole a little money. It doesn't matter much.
And it's even harder because it's a catcher, and it's so hard for catchers to actually be worthless.
Yeah.
Like, just by dint of playing catcher, you accumulate so much positional value that it's really, really hard to have, like, a negative war as a catcher. And Miguel Olivo's basically getting paid to produce, like, 0.7 war a year.
Yeah.
So
I'm trying to get the – I can't break it up on Fangraphs, but, yeah, keep talking for me. Do me a favor.
Okay, well – If you're looking for a contrast to that, because I was say, I'm pretty sure Adam Moore was like negative 0.6 war in 2010. So, yeah. But Rob Johnson, I think, was positive war. Mm-hmm. So that just goes – I mean, it's just, a lot of it comes down to the fielding too. And
okay, yeah. Here we go. For Miguel Olivo, his 104 games in the Mariner uniform, he was worth negative 0.7 war, which is bad. That's like Unayeski-Betancourt kind of war. And I'm sorry to keep saying war, but – the worst, probably the worst hitter the Mariners have ever had, ever, was those 104 games of Miguel Olivo. Two-thirds of a season of Miguel Olivo, and he was worth better than a win below replacement, just because he played catcher and because his defense was okay because he has a good arm. That's it. He was the worst hitter. He was a pitcher. He was Carlos Zambrano, basically. Worst, probably. And he still wasn't that bad. So he's not going to cripple the team, either on the field or financially. And I think people's had a visceral reaction to it because everybody has the memory. I think it's an okay signing. People just got too emotional.
Yeah. It might just be people needing to be emotional, and that's all we can give them.
When you have a lot of the offseason, that's what happens.
Yeah. I also agree that I think it's a good signing for to not have Moore come in. I didn't like the idea of a Moore-Johnson catching duo. Mm-hmm. Just because, I mean, basically, you look at it, Zrenzik kicked Moore in the ass in the media.
Yeah.
In so many words, you laid the blame on people like Adam Moore and Michael Saunders. And I think that's a good thing. I think they needed the gauntlet throw down on them. But I also think that, you know, getting basically publicly called out in the media and then being counted on to be the starter is a recipe for a player trying too hard.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever that actually means, psychobabble into performance, but it just seems like it's a better idea to have to be telling Moore, to send him the message that you want a starting job, you're gonna have to do a lot better than you did. And we're showing you this by bringing in Miguel Olivo.
I think the whole like young player prospect thing and developing player thing is just so difficult to talk about, first of all, because we don't really have that much of an idea. But if you think about it from a fan standpoint, the popular opinion is that young players, you know, they need to play as much as they can. If you have good minor league numbers, you've earned a starting spot. And people, I think, at least in the years that I've been following baseball closely, they've made fun of front offices that, you know, challenge young players with veterans. I remember the Mariners brought in Fernando Vina, do you remember, a few spring trainings ago, to challenge, like, Jose Lopez and Unayeski-Betancourt in the middle infield. And we all thought it was ridiculous. Like, Fernando Vina, what's he going to do? But sometimes the young players need – it's not just about – if you give Michael Saunders 162 games next year, maybe he'll flop. Maybe he needs some time off. Maybe he needs a veteran caddy. Maybe he needs to go back to the minors. We don't know. But just because a front office makes things difficult on a young player doesn't mean it's the front office screwing up. Young players aren't the guarantees, and you can't just treat them like they're veterans as soon as they show up, I think.
Yeah, it's hard to tell because we don't know what goes on
in
those things. So that's enough about Olivo. Let's talk about Olivo.
Brendan Ryan.
Let's talk about Brendan Ryan. And I guess an interesting, so when Brendan Ryan, we traded for him, I think my initial reaction, which I think a lot of people's was like, oh, great, there's our stopgap second baseman until Ackley comes up, and then now he's the roving utility infielder until Jack Wilson's hurt, and then he's the new starting shortstop. And that makes, you know, really intuitive sense. But then a couple of people have brought up the point that Brendan Ryan, you know, is primarily a shortstop.
Mm-hmm.
He hasn't done sample sizes be damned and such, that he hasn't done terribly great at second base
mm-hmm.
in the past. And that if the plan is really only to have a 2-month second baseman until Ackley comes up, why don't we start Brendan Ryan at shortstop and move Jack Wilson to second base? If Jack Wilson's the one who's likely to get displaced anyways, because really Brendan Ryan is a younger, more
durable,
healthy, durable, yes, less injury prone Jack Wilson. I don't know. What say you? What do you think about that?
I think it completely makes sense if you figure that at this point Jack Wilson is just treading water. I think he's a lame duck shortstop or a lame duck infielder that is clearly not part of the organizational picture going forward. He's been a big disappointment, and there's not really much benefit even to. You start the year with him at short, and you give him a chance to show that he's healthy, maybe hit a little bit, keep playing defense, then what? Nobody's going to trade you much for him. He's not a part of the future. He's 30, 90 years old. He's done, and it would be tough. I mean, you listen to Zirenzik talk about Jack Wilson, and I think he still reveres him a little bit. He still likes him as an infield leader when he's healthy. So it would be tough to tell Jack Wilson to, hey, go move, because I don't know if Jack Wilson's ever played second base. He's always been very, very good at short. So it'll be a difficult conversation, but at the same time, I mean, last year they made Lopez and Figgins switch places, for God's sake, for whatever reason that was, and they accepted it. So what would be the worst case scenario? That Jack Wilson says no? Well, it's like, okay, so we'll just kick your ass to the curb 2 months earlier than we thought we would. Then,
right.
Then what? But I don't know. I guess it really depends on what the organization feels about Brendan Ryan at second base, because if they think that Ryan at second is a real problem, or if they think he would have difficulty adjusting back to short on the fly during the year, then that's something that I think is worth pursuing. But if they're confident that Ryan can handle it for the time being, then I guess you don't risk whatever risk there is in asking Jack Wilson to move over. Although I think personally they should just do everything they can short of physically abusing him to get him, convince him to retire.
Yeah, that would be excellent. Although, well, I don't know. That would free up some payroll room for 2011, but what are we going to do with that payroll room anyways?
Yeah, it's like trading Arizona.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Other than Artsma, I think there's a little bit the argument of trying to trade Artsma before he implodes. So, you know, but Jack Wilson, it's not like we're risking trade value here. Artsma, you're risking trade value by not trading him, but Jack Wilson he's, for all intents, he's done as a starter. And so it's just kind of at the worst, you know, he does make a pretty damn good backup or utility infielder at the very least.
Does a healthy Jack Wilson bring? What's the maximum that a healthy Jack Wilson brings back in the trade? Well, a healthy younger Jack Wilson just got Michael Clito in a trade. So if you're holding out for Jack Wilson to be healthy and bring back a trade return, you would just get Michael Clito back probably. And that's really not worth anything.
It's not worth anything. So I warm to the idea of having Ryan shift Wilson to second base, because after seeing what Figgins' defense did at second base this past year, mm-hmm. I'm now kind of all about the, let's just leave people at their natural positions unless we absolutely really have to move them.
Mm-hmm.
And, so let's leave Ryan at shortstop and Jack can deal with it. And
I'm checking.
I'd also like to be, do we have confirmation that Figgins is moving back to third? I mean, have they like come out and said that?
They have not come out and said that because they don't come out and say anything, but I think this is one of those things where you can probably infer
that they haven't, because they haven't signed anybody who could play third base.
And just because Ackley's going to, you have to assume Ackley's up in June, I think. They're obviously not going to start the year with him, just because that would be stupid from every standpoint. But you got to, you got a plan on Avin coming up, and you, I don't think you want to move Figgins during the year. I mean, he's talked about how much he likes having a set position. He would probably like to know that he's playing third. And yeah. Unless the organization thinks that Eck is a year away for some reason, I have to think it's just the overwhelming probability.
Those are all logical statements. I'm just saying, you know, I'm a little bit more cautious these days after 2010 of saying things like, oh, well, you just have to assume based on overwhelming probability. That, like, well, you know what? I would be really nice if I could just have some sort of statement from Wedge or Zarenzic or Blangine or anything that says, like, yeah, we anticipate Sean Figgins being our everyday third baseman or whatever. Mm-hmm. So we don't get into some crazy thing where, no, he's going to start at second base. What are you talking about? And then we're going to move to Ackley to third, or I don't know.
Ackley's going to catch. What?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Weird, but okay.
Just so you know, I have no documented history of Jack Wilson playing second base as a professional at any level.
Yeah, he is not. But, I mean, come on. How hard could it be as a shortstop?
No, absolutely. But then I know. There are so many things that seem to fit, and it seems like we can plan what the Mariners are going to do. But you never know, because, I mean, it was the first day of spring training last year that they were like, oh, by the way, two veterans are changing positions.
Yeah.
Just for funsies. Surprise! It's just an experiment. No, it's not. You're doing it.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't imagine that they looked so good in spring training that the Mariners are like, all right, yeah, that confirmed it. No, they had their minds made up.
And you know what? It worked. It boosted up Jose Lopez's trade value all the way to, what the hell did we get?
Chaz Rowe,
yeah. Woo. I mean, who would have thought sitting here 1 year ago today that we would actually have been able to trade Jose Lopez for somebody as prestigious and coveted as Chaz Rowe?
Chaz. Row backwards is Eeyore, which I like. I'm not going to call him anything, to be honest, because he's never going to come up. He's nothing. Like, he's going to come up as often as Andy Baldwin, who, by the way, signed elsewhere a week ago, and I had no idea. That's going to be Chaz Rowe.
Most assuredly. Much like I totally forgot that Miguel Calito was even in the organization until we traded him.
Yeah, I couldn't remember who had the visa trouble, and I didn't
know. That was Cleo.
Him? Yeah, I wonder if he was still stuck in the Caribbean for some reason.
Now you can be stuck in the Caribbean for St. Louis.
It's your legal problem now. Best pitcher in the Dominican. Let's see, did you want to say anything?
Speaking of the Dominican, the Mariners have been active in one sense of the offseason, and that's signing up those Latin bonus babies.
Well, they got the one.
Well, plus the one that we signed in July.
Yeah, this offseason.
Well, it's the international offseason.
And I guess for all intents and purposes, the Mariners offseason started in May.
Yeah.
We've had a long time to prepare for this.
It's true.
Yeah.
And it gets to keep on going because we get the number 2 draft pick next June.
Yeah,
that's going to be awesome. We're going to add some talent to this organization.
Yep. Talent.
I just remembered that we.
Yeah, no.
It seems like we have a dominating international draft class this year, which, you know, will pay
dividends.
Well, it may not pay any dividends, but if it does pay dividends, we'll pay dividends in, you know, 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, you know, when Felix is a free agent.
Yeah.
I do think it's fun having the number 2 draft pick and having it come during the next year because you get so much, you get like, what is it, 8 months of separation from remembering, oh yeah, the Mariners lost 101 games.
Right.
You push it out of your mind, then you're like, oh right, second pick.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it becomes something to look forward to rather than, it's not like,
it was kind of, you know, just like in 2009 when we were going through our resurgence and it was like, holy crap, this team's good. And now we get Dustin Ackley.
Yeah. We're going to use that as a quick segue into the remaining two topics that we're going to cover real quick, which is the re-signing of Eric Bedard and also some things to expect from Michael Pineda. So, Matthew, kick us off.
Well, Bedard would, I think, conclude our meaningful transactions since the last podcast. We're obviously not going to go through the minor league free agents because whatever. Yeah. But Bedard, really, I mean, yeah, okay, he's healthy again, and expectations, et cetera, so forth and so on.
Yeah, it's hard. It's so hard because nobody is just so fragile that it's, that they're, like, Eric Bedard will have healthy days, you know? He's not the Mr. Glass or whatever it was from Unbreakable, you know? He's a human. He's not just guaranteed to fall apart. He has built himself into a professional major league pitcher. So it's really hard to read the medical or, you know, read the medical reports, hear about the medical reports, and come away not feeling encouraged because the Mariners say he's healthy. He should compete for a spot in spring training. And you kind of think, well, he's had so many things repaired that he should be the strongest he's ever been. He should,
right.
It's like he's been reset to factory standards or whatever. Yeah, he's referring back to what I was looking for. And so you think, well, maybe. And then that's the whole thing about Eric Bedard. Just, well, maybe. And it's fun and awful. And, I mean, I've written about it before, but I think it's a lot of fun to have a guy like Bedard almost healthy.
Right. I think it also helps that he's such, I don't even want to use the word professional about it, but he just seems like such a nice guy. In the way he's, you know, he didn't want to leave Seattle on bad terms, and it's twice now that he signed really, really low contracts to come back. And we do have to remember that, I mean, man, he made it all the way to his supposed to be only Tacoma rehab start. He was literally next step, Seattle rotation.
Yeah.
And then it all fell apart again with, what was it, just like scar tissue that needed to get taken out or something?
Bone spur in a shoulder.
Bone spur, right, which is not a serious thing. If this was anybody else, if this was Felix, who had a bone spur removed, or Doug Fister, if you're uncomfortable with the idea of Felix at all on a surgeon's knife. If Doug Fister had gotten a bone spur removed from his shoulder in August of 2010 and they were saying, well, he should be ready in spring training, we wouldn't be batting an eye about it. We'd be like, yeah, no, that's about right. It's just the fact that, it, much like with Miguel Olivo, there's the history behind Eric Bedard, which is not unreasonable, but, you know, if the plus side with Eric Bedard is that if he is healthy, if he's even not healthy, but if he's able to pitch, he's going to be good. I mean, he's, even when he was hurt, he provided quite a bit of value to the Mariners just with his small amount of innings total. So, and he's just so much fun to root for.
Yeah, he works on a slow, which is annoying, but you take that, you accept it.
Maybe he was just working really slow because it hurts so much, and now it won't hurt, so he'll work faster.
Yeah. I think one of the cool things about Bedard is that it helps keep, you know, fans are going to be a little optimistic, but at the same time, fans won't expect anything from him. No Mariners fan is counting on Eric Bedard to contribute anything, I think, next year. And it helps keep people realistic. Because it's easy to look at Sean Fick and think, well, he's only a year separated from what he did with the Angels in 2009. He was so good, all these players can bounce back. Bedard kind of keeps you realistic.
Almost, plus the salary.
Yeah, plus the salary, you know, which is nothing.
Yeah, so it's even if he doesn't do anything, even if he spends the whole year on the disabled list again, I can't get mad at him because he's costing the team nothing.
Yeah.
And it's not like our playoff hopes are hinging on him.
Well, it could be.
They could be. If Eric Bedard comes back and has like a 6-win season, then who knows? But
since we're right up against, let's real quick, Michael Pineda. We'll talk about him more in for the podcast, of course, but let's just touch on
and
him
in posts because he's going to be a really big deal in 2011.
Yeah, I
guess the question is whether or not he'll break with the team, and that may have something to do with, you know, where Eric Bedard is. If Eric Bedard is healthy enough to start the year of the team, that gives the team Felix, Vargas, Fister, Bedard, and then Pineda, Luke French, David Pauly, Garrett Olson, all those other people. That's probably a good enough cover to send Michael Pineda back down to Tacoma, which is what they need to do, both because he needs to refine some stuff and, you know, service time.
Yeah.
There's just no point in calling up Michael Pineda early on what's not looking like a year that is going to be a playoff one.
Right. Like, obviously, the Braves had Jason Hayward up with them from opening day last year, but the Braves figured they were World Series contenders, and they were. The Giants waited to call up Buster Posey because they weren't quite sure. Turns out they won the World Series, but they also get the extra year because they waited.
Yeah.
I mean, to get the extra year, you only have to hold off on Pineda for literally like 2 weeks. If you want to build the Super 2, it's like a month and a half, which is a little trickier, but then that's just money as opposed to actual years of control. it's right. less of a big deal.
Yeah.
So the Giants actually, Buster Posey, I think, is in line to be a Super 2, but they get the year.
Yeah, and that's all that matters. And especially, and just by dint of being a starting pitcher who only gets the throw every once every 5 or 6 days, that it's really just being like, well, we just want to see him get 5 starts down in Tacoma. That's all you're really missing. And 5 starts is a month.
Yeah.
So that, and really, that's all we would be missing out of Michael Pineda, even if he were major league ready right now, which I don't think, you know, he could be, but this isn't exactly 2005 Felix or something like that. You know, this is, but, with that covered, assuming, you know, he will be up late May, June, and assuming he pitches, I don't know, what would you call? They'll probably shut him down again, towards September because we'll be out of it. Mm-hmm. So I would assume probably something around, I guess, 100 innings with the Mariners.
My conservative estimate is that Pineda ends up throwing about those 100 innings. And, I think they're going to be 100 electrifying and really inconsistent innings.
Yeah. He can provide a lot of value in 100 innings. Cliff Lee only pitched 100 innings with the Mariners, but of course that's, you know, the 100 best innings ever thrown by anybody ever in any sport on any planet or universe or time dimension. But, and Pineda's not going to be anywhere near that, but he could still provide, I mean, Eric Bedard has thrown, you know, he had 2 seasons of less than 100 innings and he managed to throw in, you know, a good like 1.5 worth of value in each of those, so. If Michael Pineda is at all living up to his kind of realistic potential, I think, just not assuming he comes in and dominates, but he's got enough stuff that he should be able to survive.
Yeah, and it'll just be fun. Once the Mariners drop out of the race, he'll be something to look forward to. You know, it's not David Pauly's useful and all, but nobody wants to watch David Pauly. If you go to Safeco and you have tickets, and it's like, who's pitching that? David Pauly against the Orioles. Who gives a fuck? But if it's Michael Pineda against anybody, then it becomes a game that you look forward to. Not because, I mean, even if the game's irrelevant, you don't know. Maybe that's the moment Pineda arrives. Maybe he does more than that. He should be an electrifying pitcher to watch for all the usual reasons. And, he's just going to be a lot of fun. Just because, I mean, he doesn't even know what press coverage is or attention is like. He's going to,
It is a pretty meteoric rise through the minor leagues for him the last year and a half. So yeah, it might be, you know, him a little bit over his head and maybe he'll say something funny in the press, not knowing not to, probably in Spanish. So,
yeah. I think unfortunately now we have to cut off because I'm out of time. I have to go and we will talk about Pineda more. And for the time being, hey, you're welcome for a new podcast. Hope you enjoyed it, including the
No more Jose Lopez!
No more Jose Lopez! Well, thank you very much, Matthew, and thank you guys for listening if you made it this far, and until next time.